in 2003, I went to the Audio Engineering Society convention in New York City. And if I can get this slide up here, and if it doesn't move away, they had an exhibit with old digital tape recorders, stuff that, unless you've been around since the dawn of digital, you may not have heard of: Soundstream tape recorders, Mitsubishi Dash units from Sony and Studer and so on. And they were doing demos and so on, and historical stories about the birth of the digital recording era. And I saw this fellow give a presentation. You can see the slide there. This was in 2003, New York City. And I heard him speak, and he said it was from Battelle. And I said, well, that's Washington State. That's kind of interesting. And didn't think too much more about that. But he was talking about the invention of basic technology for compact discs. And then, like some of you, I saw this article in the Seattle Times, November 29th, 2004. And by gosh, there he is again. He lives in Bellevue. I figured that's a meeting. And the reporter told him that I asked. He didn't actually give me his email address first. I guess they try to protect the right people on the article. But he did contact me and said he'd do it. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce James Russell. And he's going to tell us about his part in the invention of digital optical recording.
Thank you. Well, sure enough, this picture shows a lot of old things, yeah. As well as sound recorders. I'd like to talk, say a few bits, really, about the optical digital recording technology, how it was initially conceived, developed, engineered, and eventually how it became expressed as the CD, CD-ROM, DVD, and all that sort of stuff. I hope that I don't say too many bits for... Well, it has often been said that necessity is the mother of invention, and that was certainly the case here. I wanted a better phonograph, one that had less background noise, less distortion, various problems, and they tend to wear out too fast, as far as I was concerned. Now, I'm not sure that this desire would fall under the classification of necessity, but I was after it in a intensive sort of way. Now, the industry understood that an LP could be read optically, and if so, it would not deteriorate. And there were a number of inventors that cranked up various schemes for doing that, but none of them were very successful. In fact, none of them worked, really, or they were very expensive. So it occurred to me in early 1965, that if you can think back that far, that a music record should be made in a different form, one that is more suited to an optical pickup. Analog coding systems such as binary analog FM or pulse width modulation were well developed for audio and telemetry at the time. And it was clear that if a record was made with appropriate grooves or bumps corresponding to an FM or a PWM arrangement, that you could read these bumps and so on optically. But it seemed to me these binary systems are still analog and have the disadvantage that the medium is not passive. That is, random physical inaccuracies of the manufacturing process or grain, if there's any grain in the material itself, will introduce noise or distortion into the reproduced sound. Well, a binary PCM, pulse code modulation, usually, not exactly, but usually called digital, system has a record that is passive in principle. and can be made almost perfectly in practice. Further, in a digital system, you have many computer-like functions that you can't get in the analog world, such as multiple channels, lots of channels, addresses, machine commands, title displays, and you know, that kind of thing. Now, PCM does have some disadvantages, and one disadvantage is that the electronics are much more complex, particularly high-precision A to D and D to A circuits, and any sort of an error correction detection circuits can be pretty hairy. But it was clear to me that the recently developed integrated circuit techniques, I remember this 40 years ago, would eventually allow very sophisticated electronic systems to be built at a very low cost. And indeed, that did turn out to be the case. Another disadvantage with PCM was that that music was not, the possibility of PCM coding for music was not appreciated in the industry, even though Bell Labs had been tinkering with PCM for telephony for some number of years. Well, all this is interesting, but optical digital coding on a record only solved part of the problem. A symphony rendered in PCM would comprise a huge volume of bits. Such a volume could only be stored on existing digital computer magnetic tape, you know, these big reels of tapes, great big machines. This would be, this sort of process is much too expensive for any sort of a mass market. However, if the physical size of each bit could be reduced to the order of a micron, then a symphony might be recorded on a 3x5 card sort of shape, 3x5 inch, in stereo. I knew that bits that size and smaller could be made and observed with a microscope. Pretty good microscope, but still a microscope-type technology. So the top-level concept was to convert music to digital form and record the bits by making micron-sized marks on an optically sensitive medium. A light source that could be flashed quickly would cause the marks, and an optical mechanical system would scan the light over a record surface. The considerable problems of mechanical precision would be solved by servo control. That was a little optimistic as it turned out, but that's the general idea. Well, I was working for Battelle Memorial Institute over in Richland at the time, and they had just taken over the laboratories, so I wrote and submitted an invention report and all that stuff, and my managers encouraged me to proceed with an expanded development of the concept. So by the summer of 1965, I had entered a more detailed description into my lab book and written additional invention reports. I'd laid out several different mechanical scanning systems, including a spinning disc with a lead screw to move an optical head across the radius under track servo control, moving optical tape, a moving card, a fixed record with mechanical and electromechanical scanner systems. In every case, the proposed systems would make use of a record that could be cheaply replicated by optical means. As, for example, copying a photograph, or by embossing, or thermoplastic molding, or lithography, or some just straightforward printing schemes, which might or might not have worked. And the record would have a transparent protective layer on top to top of the data to keep scratches and dust and so on out of focus. And I had a sync system suggested that was suited to digital optical records. I realized at the time that the sync systems, word sync and bit sync, for magnetic tape systems wouldn't really work for optical systems. Well, by this time it was clear that besides stereo, Actually, we called it hi-fi at the time. The system could be used to any sort of information storage or publishing. Newspapers and magazines could be replaced with attendant enormous savings in trees. Complete personal records, including scanned x-rays, could be carried by everyone. Computer data, large application programs could be inexpensively reproduced and distributed. And video records for consumers or professionals would be especially convenient and cheap. Well, with apologies to Charles Dickens, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. It was the best of times for an inventor because there was essentially no prior art, so one could run off in all directions. It was the worst of times for an inventor because there was essentially no prior art, so it was hard to prove to people that it was possible. Even technical professionals, it was not unusual to hear someone say, if it can be done and it's as good as you say, how come IBM hasn't patented it? Now, we're talking about electronic engineers and physicists here, even some normal people. Well, fortunately, a hero showed up. There were several heroes in the whole development of this technology. There were a number of villains, but I won't talk about them. As I mentioned, I was working for Battelle. Well, Battelle is a not-for-profit institution. However, they had a subsidiary at the time called Battelle Development Corporation, which was just a bunch of lawyers, really, specifically for the purpose of making money from licensing things were developed in the laboratory or, you know, really any kind of a legal enterprise that would raise money. So my idea was presented to them as well. And the key man at Battelle Development Corporation, BDC, was a Dr. Cloyd Snavely. He realized the potential, recognized that it was probably feasible, encouraged me personally, and provided some money to begin some demonstrations. It seems very strange now, but the first thing that we had to do, had to demonstrate to BDC, was that it was possible to digitize and reconstruct music. We used, that'll come up again, a very important point. We used a PDP-7 computer that we had available at the time, and with, I think it was a 12-bit A to D, D to A unit on it, and a pocket radio for an audio source. The next thing to show was whether it was possible to make micron-sized spots over a many square inch area. Well, it took a couple of years to work that out in detail, but we did some laboratory demonstrations fairly quickly that demonstrated that it really should be feasible. Dick Hoke, my office partner at the time, helped and encouraged immeasurably. Then, in the fall of 1966, BDC filed the first of what was to be a family of patent applications. Each member of the family would cover a different embodiment or a different feature. For example, a transparent cover layer or a sync system or other things that were sort of in the list of things to cover with patents. For several political reasons, after the first application, all funding was cut off, and the family of patents concept was scrapped. At the time, one could argue it was justifiable. By hindsight, it was a very expensive error for Battelle Development Corporation. Well, in March 1970, the first patent issued, and suddenly the idea seemed more feasible. I'm not sure why. The patent doesn't add anything to the context of the technology, but anyway, I guess the point was that the patent office thought that was novel, which doesn't mean much. BDC started marketing the idea. In December of 1971, a financier venture capitalist Eli S. Jacobs became interested. He was a New York fellow, and formed a company called Digital Recording Corporation. Digital Recording Corporation, DRC, made a license agreement with Battelle Development Corporation and agreed to fund R&D at Battelle and Richland for a while, a year or so. So in January 72, the development fund began. A simple-minded assessment of the TV... I skipped an important point here. Though Jacobs recognized there was a good market for stereo, he realized, rightly, that the stereo player was not the most challenging technology. So he decided that the first prototype recorder player should be aimed at consumer video. It required high data rate, high density, high reliability, low-cost players and records, and if we could demonstrate such a prototype system, well, then we could do almost any other application. If we could not, well, at least we had some idea of how far we could go with the technology. So I started thinking high data rates in February of 72. A simple-minded assessment of the TV signal suggested that after digitizing, I could do a little rearranging of the format, such as putting information in the horizontal and vertical blanks, do a little compression, and perhaps then I could get down to neighborhood of 25, middle 20s megabits per second data rate. I chose a mechanical structure based on that assumed data rate and the related centimeters per second velocity along a scanning velocity. I wasn't sure that we could make data spots smaller than a micron, center to center. One limitation on density was set by any grain in the recording material. Materials that are essentially grainless, such as diazo or photoresist, were certainly available at the time, but we did not have the freedom to buy a blue-green laser for writing on those types of materials. However, we could buy a high-resolution silver halide emulsion on glass plates from Kodak. They were rectangular glass plates and off the shelf, readily available, inexpensive, relatively speaking, and they could be used with a helium neon laser. Calculations suggested that if we wanted to use a disc as a record that was, say, 6 inches or so in diameter, we'd have to spin it in the range of up to 8,000 RPM, assuming constant linear velocity in the inner tracks. I did not think it would be a good idea to try and spin a rectangular glass plate at that sort of speed. Possible, but a little dangerous. So I chose a fixed record system with a multi-objective moving scanner. This design is shown in the first slide, which I'll try and get here. Look, there it is. Okay, we have a wheel with four microscope objectives in the wheel, and there's a drive motor that's not shown, of course, and the beam from the laser and modulator and so on comes in the backside and is parallel to the shaft, but offset a little bit. And on the back of the shaft is a four-face pyramidal mirror. So the laser hits the face of the mirror, bounces off the fixed mirror, and comes up to the active microscope objective at the time. And the trick is that as one microscope objective goes off the record, and the next one is then coming on the record, at the same instant, the beam switches over the ridge from one face of the pyramidal mirror to the other. So it switches the beam automatically, so to speak. This particular drawing is for a transmissive record, and so we had a big bundle of fibers to collect the light that comes through and put into a detector. a point here is that the tracks on the record are arcuate in shape, roughly, 90 degree sort of a range. Later on, that was a transmissive record. Later on, we did a reflective record, and like present day systems. We also had a tracking system, which was just behind the pyramid on the back of the machine, with a galvanometer to wiggle it appropriately. The tracks on the arc would hold actually 66 television lines. So it was not one television line per arc. And each television line was pretty small, 2-3 millimeters or so on the arc. Now, for recording, the system was run open loop, alas. So bearing runout was a great concern. And after some engineering and considerable trial and error, we were able to get a stability and runout of better than a quarter micron peak to peak using ball bearings. Not as good as a modern fluid bearing, but good enough. We recognized at the time that other configurations and certainly plastic records would be better for most markets, but we were trying to demonstrate principles at the lowest possible cost and quickest possible time. We had a team of three, a first-class electronic engineer, Ray Walker, and a very capable mechanical technician, Larry Kopf. We realized we would need a variety of skills and knowledge beyond those at hand at Battelle: TV format, video processing, data formatting, data compression, laser modulation, laser modulation compensation, geometrical optics, physical optics, precision mechanicals, especially bearings, photosensitive chemistry and processing, optical tracking and data synchronization, servo control, and video signal reconstruction. In short, apart from the skills in digital logic that Ray had and a little bit of optics that I had, we did not know what we were doing. And there was no model, no prior art. We rule of thumb, looks about right. And we learned a lot. It was fun. Now, I have a few slides left that are relevant. Most of the slides and pictures that I had were destroyed in various moves. Battelle has the originals of the pictures, and of course they have my notebooks in their archives, but it turns out to be expensive to get anything out of those archives. And unfortunately, the pictures that you will see were made by the publicity department, which means that the equipment per se is not really the focus of the picture. Okay, now, first thing you got to do is ignore that grinning doofus in the background. let me see, maybe we need to get the lights down a bit more. It kind of works, I guess. The wheel is back there. This is the shaft, the motor drive. This is the top end of the galvanometer that goes down inside there and wheels the beam back and forth. The beam comes in from off over here, out in the hall someplace, and takes a right angle and goes into the machine. And then this whole thing is part of a carriage that slides back and forth and is driven by this lead screw. This is looking at it from a slightly different angle. I have some 8x10s here with me that anyone that's interested can get a little better view of just how this thing is was put together. But in any event, I was supposed to be putting a record into the system, and preparatory to playback or something like that.
So those plates were regular photographic.
Well, they were silver halide. They're not the sort of thing that you do portraits with.
No.
They were originally made for high-resolution spectroscopy and for astronomy, for very fine grain material, and very slow. Okay, the electronics part of the demonstration system that we assembled started with off-the-air television signals. The signal was converted to the luminance and color components, Y, I, and Q. Each was separately digitized with I and Q at about a fifth of the Y rate. We could do that because the spatial bandwidth of the I is much lower for color than it is for luminance. Each sample was compressed by a simple-minded differential coding, about 2.5 to 1. And trading again on the low I response for color, each recorded TV line contained Y and one related color. And the other color from the previous line that had been stored in a buffer. So on a video screen, the vertical resolution for color was half that of the luminance, and horizontally, one-fifth of the luminance. Well, that sounds pretty grim, but hey, it looks all right. It really does. And in fact, I believe it's still the case. One is about a fifth, but the other is more like a third or something like that. Okay, the assembled data stream also included stereo synchronizing words and sector address placed in the horizontal. All of that was put in the horizontal blanks. Even so, the data rate was still 21 megabits per second. We contemplated more effective compression algorithms such as interframe differential, subNyquist sampling, interpolation of offset fields, multiple layers, Walsh transforms, all kinds of weird stuff. But we wanted to keep the whole thing simple and straightforward. The assembled data that we put together by putting everything, all the bits, all in a proper string, modulated the writing laser in time, that is, it generated bits, flashed bits, and also a separate circuit that modulated the amplitude of the laser bits a little bit on a bit-by-bit basis. And this is to compensate for the peculiarities of silver halide. Now, I have a picture of one of our records. This is the banding on this record is sort of incidental. We were doing some exposure tests. The main.
How much video does that card hold? That 3x1 or whatever it is?
It's a 4x5. It would. In this version, it would hold about 20 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There were the earlier versions were 3 minutes.
Minutes is quite impressive.
Yeah.
Really?
And, wait till you see some of the pictures that came off it. You won't think it's so impressive. I did bring along a real, actual record for later show and tell, if anyone's interested. The next slide is a... Next slide is a picture of one of our records, a photomicrograph. And Now the spacing from the bit-to-bit spacing is 1 micron, which means that this is a 1-0, 1-0, 1-0, 1-0 sort of a pattern, or otherwise 2 microns between black spots. The spacing between lines on this particular example is 4 microns, which is rather more than one needs, but it shows what we were doing at the time. Now, the recording light, you would consider that to be a return to zero, in that we had a flash of light for each bit and nothing in between flashes. But due to the action of silver halide emulsions, it tends to grow together. And so it really kind of ends up being a non-return to zero on the record. But that's all right. Playback was done in the same machine. During playback, the track servo would lock on to the end of the track on the... let me see. How do we turn the lights on here? Leave some light so I can see what I'm looking at here. The physical line that was the whole arc that was on the plate, and that would start with the bit clock and pick that up real quick, and then we would go into our word clock synchronization at the start of the physical line, and then at each of the TV lines as it goes along would reinitialize the word clock. And then the data were all sent into a digital state machine that would sort out the audio and command codes and color, and then to a video and waveform generator chips. In many ways, it was crude. For example, we did not add niceties such as buffer registers for the physical lines or error correction, so there were lots of noise, especially in the video. We did use a buffer and a parity detection for the audio using a play the sample again type correction. But we felt these niceties and numerous other improvements were obvious and not necessary to the principle. We got our first recognizable video in January of 1973 and full frame color in January of 74. Although the press notices started going out in June of 72. It's sometimes hard to keep salespeople under control. the next picture is... I need it on again. This is another publicity shot, it is of the sponsor, actually the sponsored representative, and me looking at a record. But the important part here is in the back, we have a monochrome monitor and a color monitor reading off one of our records. The picture is of, I remember his name in a minute, Robert McNamara, who at the time was with the World Bank. Entirely irrelevant to the story, but yeah, there he was. And you know, you can see that there's a lot of noise. We were pretty happy to be able to get that sort of a picture out of the thing. Also, on the left, pretty hard for you to see, I think. Again, we can probably get a better view with some pictures that I have with me. These are also photographs taken, Polaroids taken off pictures anyway, taken off the monitor, and some of them look a little better than that one. I did bring along a few surviving Polaroid shots that were made of the early days, the very first stuff that we got off our recording device, and I don't have slides made of them. We also made a videotape of segments of two programs that were recorded off the air. Usually our trial recordings were made in the middle of the morning, so they were soap operas, or in the middle of the afternoon, which was usually a children's program called, I think, Romper Room. These tapes should be in the Battelle archives, but we could not find them easily. In July 1973, a patent application was filed that specifically describes a type of synchronization techniques for optical records. The most significant embodiment makes use of unique code words in the data stream to provide synchronization for the word clock. The point of the unique code is that it is logically distinguishable from the data, yet optically is identical with the data. This is the system that is used in the CD, CD-ROM, and so forth. Visitors started coming in mid-1973 to see demonstrations. I think the first was an engineer from Mitsubishi Electric, followed shortly by GM Research, Bell & Howell, Hitachi, Ricoh, and RCA Princeton. Interestingly, the RCA people said that Princeton Labs had never considered digital audio or digital video. Sony sent a communications engineer from the videotape recorder group in August of 74. Then in September of 74, a representative of Polygram Philips came. Now, Polygram at the time was a subsidiary of Philips and Siemens, and they made LPs. Had several different labels, as I recall. This fellow stated that Philips had not been considering digital optical, and he doubted that they ever would. A bit pessimistic, as it turned out. In October, we sent out a general technical brochure that we called the Blue Book, because it had a blue cover on it, to about 1,000 people. The gist of the brochure was that optical digital is the way to go, the wave of the future, that it is a particularly great medium for stereo and video, and the particular embodiment shown was of a card system, but the message was very clear. Following the Philips visit, our sponsor, the president actually of DRC, the guy that you saw here on the slide, visited Philips in Eindhoven, in the Netherlands, in November of 74. He touted our system for audio and video and optical digital storage in general. And I was told that at the meeting, the consumer electronics lead from Philips said that digitizing analog signals such as audio and video could not be done. Because how can you take an analog signal and convert it into numbers and expect to get anything back out? Well, as it happened, there were some communication-savvy engineers in the room, and they straightened him out right away. But it was clear that Philips had indeed never considered optical digital, at least until near the end of 1974. As a result of that meeting, in January 75, two Philips engineers visited Battelle to see their prototype, one from NV Philips, Eindhoven, the other from North American Philips, New York, Briar Manor. They stated to me there was no optical digital recording work being done at Philips, and there would not be any in the foreseeable future, short future. Throughout the remainder of 1975 and on through 1980, we visited or had visitors from many U.S. companies and foreign companies and government agencies and so forth, including Ampex, Harris, Toshiba, Olympus, Xerox, EMI, IBM, and Fuji, to name just a few. In April 1976, the late Tom Stockham visited. As some of you may know, he came to talk about his new company, Soundstream. As some of you may know, Tom not only was the past president of the AES, but he was the pioneer in the U.S. for mastering music in digital form on magnetate tape. He essentially built his own A to D units to give a true 16-bit conversion at 50 kilohertz, and then used a Honeywell 1-inch instrument magnetic tape to hold four tracks at the start and eight tracks later on. Then he used a large PDP-11 computer, at least two disk packs, to do all the editing and so forth that people do now. He also developed the algorithms for reconstructing old recordings, in particular, or most notably, the Caruso reconstructed recordings. A brilliant fellow. Well, in 1980, Jacobs decided that it would be better to set up a separate company to develop the technology, especially stereo. Accordingly, Digital Recording Corporation had an IPO, and as part of the deal, and because of the interest in stereo, the Digital Recording Corporation bought Soundstream to become DRC Soundstream. A facility was leased in Salt Lake City, where Soundstream had been operating, and all the equipment and technology was transferred there from Battelle, a whole moving van full of equipment. Ray Walker and I quit Battelle and moved to Salt Lake City in the spring of 81. At Salt Lake City, there was two distinct operations. One was the continuation and expansion of the optical digital development, particularly for stereo, and the other quite separate operation was the Soundstream mastering and editing operation. These latter operations were greatly expanded with the money from the IPO, with additional studios set up in Los Angeles, New York, London, Nashville, and Germany. the optical team the optical team built a card-based stereo record recorder player that can be seen in the next slide. This is maybe about a third of the size of the other one, and had a recording material in it that was a little bit different. It was one that we had made, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Then in 1984, a Sony representative was asked in an amazingly unsophisticated way whether Sony would like to pay royalties on my patents. You can imagine their answer. For several reasons, the company ran out of money and began shutting down in July of 84. The editing function continued with a skeleton staff for a few months, but in the spring of 1985, the optical equipment, technology, and intellectual property, there was 23 or 24 patents by that time, were sold to a startup company in Toronto called Optical Recording Corporation. Most of the Salt Lake City Soundstream equipment went there also, though the equipment in the New York studio was sold to RCA and was operated there by RCA for several years, I think. In any event, I moved to Toronto, now with two moving vans full of equipment, getting up in the world, on a two-year consulting contract with incentives. The emphasis in Toronto was, first, on developing a novel recording medium that was what I showed you here, that attempted to improve the sensitivity by mixing into the emulsion an explosive. Now, you must understand that this was not something that a terrorist would use. It was all spread out and very innocuous, really, but when you focus to a micron sort of a spot with the laser energy, that would set off a very sensitive material, and it wasn't really all that good, but it worked. and it was certainly novel. And besides developing that, we did some more commercially oriented mechanical designs, in particular for audio and mass storage. But this time I managed to convince the owner and his patent agent that some of my patents covered the general concept, data format, and synchronization scheme of the compact disc, and predated any work by Philips or any other identifiable entity by many years. In 1986, all companies that were in the CD business were notified that they infringed. After I was no longer involved with the technology, Optical Recording Corporation began licensing companies. The first was Sony in the spring of 1988. Later, the company licensed Philips and several other equipment companies. Then in May of 1992, ORC brought an infringement suit against Time Warner and other disc-making companies. The trial lasted about 5 weeks. The patents were judged to be valid and were intentionally infringed, making Time Warner et al. Liable for triple damages. ORC won a $30 million initial judgment. By this time, 1992, the key patents had expired, and that is the end of my history story. It was an interesting time. Recently, as a result of contacts with industry insiders, I have constructed a reasonable scenario of what happened in the late 70s at Philips. It appears there were three factions, at least. One was the Polygram LP group. Their position was that the LP was profitable, used a well-understood technology, and don't fool around with newfangled technology. Let's stick with what we got. The second faction was the Laser Vision group. They were manufacturing an analog FM, PWM record for optical disc analog for video applications. But it had problems and was not selling well. Their position was money should be put into a small audio record based on their optical FM technology. And then there was the digital group, after January 75 at least. Fortunately, they prevailed. It is clear to me that our work instigated and undoubtedly accelerated the advent of optical digital records, the CD, CD-ROM, and DVD, by at least several years. Now, unquestionably, the CD and progeny likely would never have appeared on the market without the enormous engineering, development, marketing, and standardization efforts of Philips, Sony, and several other companies. In fact, at the time, Philips and Sony were probably unique among companies of the world, perhaps still are, in their ability to bring it all together. It was a huge investment, at least of the order of $1 billion to get it on the market. I think it was a lot more than Philips had in mind in the first place. It's interesting to speculate what might have happened if Philips had proceeded with the LP or the FM audio product. The optical digital infrastructure would not have been developed. The Reed-Solomon correction code formulas would not have been translated into silicon. The substantial problems of polycarbonate injection molding would not have been worked out. The driving force for cheap semiconductor lasers would be blunted, still go on, but various electronics such as low-cost precision A to D and D to A would not have been developed, all necessary for the CD-ROM. Would a CD-ROM equivalent have been developed eventually? Probably, but the product might be much more expensive because it could not be based on the huge manufacturing efficiencies and large initial investments of the CD. If that were the case, the ascendancy of the personal computer and the software industry would have been substantially moderated and delayed. And substantially, that's my story.